A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
We've talked about plastics on this show more times than I can count. Euroboxes, HDPE, industrial formulations. But Daniel sent us a prompt that made me realize we've never actually answered the most basic question. Here's what he wrote. We've talked in a number of episodes about plastics, and today we challenge the simple narrative that plastic is bad and unsustainable, even if for many plastics that's true. We've talked about Euroboxes, and industrial plastics, and HDPE. We've underscored how different those are from single-use plastics. So maybe it's time that we took a step back and delved into the most elemental question, which is, what are plastics in the first place? Most of us know that plastics have something to do with oil, that they aren't biodegradable, and that microplastics have become a major concern. But plastics aren't homogeneous. We know that not only from our own episodes, but from plastic labeling codes. So we're talking about materials that are different in some respect. What's their commonality? From a biodegradability and microplastic standpoint, how much of a difference do the different types and formulations make? Or, looking at the question from the other direction, are there specific variants that are more problematic than others? As our societies move towards different usages and material scientists find new answers to sometimes long-standing challenges, that's a lot. But it's the right question.
It really is. And I love that Daniel framed it around the labeling codes, because those little triangles with numbers, they're the one thing most people have actually seen. They're printed on everything. But they're also deeply misleading if you treat them as an environmental scorecard, which is what most people do.
So let's start with the question the prompt asks. What do all plastics actually have in common?
The honest answer is, almost nothing, except one thing. All plastics are polymers. Long chains of repeating molecular units called monomers. That's it. That's the definition.
Which means calling something a plastic is about as specific as calling something a building. A shed and a cathedral are both buildings.
And the confusion starts right there, because most people think plastics share other properties. That they're all made from oil, that they're all non-biodegradable, that they're all synthetic. None of those things are true across the board. PLA, polylactic acid, is made from cornstarch. It's a plastic. Cellulose acetate, the stuff in old photographic film, comes from wood pulp. Also a plastic. Some plastics will sit in a landfill for centuries. Others will hydrolyze in hot water.
So, the plastic is plastic. Narrative fails before you even get past the first sentence.
It fails spectacularly. And the reason it persists is that we've built this entire cultural category around a word that describes a molecular architecture, not a set of material properties. A polymer chain can be linear, branched, cross-linked. It can have a backbone made of pure carbon-carbon bonds, or it can have oxygen and nitrogen atoms woven in. It can be rigid or flexible, transparent or opaque, brittle or tough. All of that comes down to what the chain looks like and what's been mixed into it.
And the mixing in part. That's where it gets even messier, because a plastic object is never just the polymer.
Never. That's the second thing people get wrong. When you hold a plastic bottle or a food container, you're holding a composite. The polymer is the scaffold, but it's loaded with additives. Plasticizers to make it flexible, stabilizers to keep it from yellowing in sunlight, flame retardants, colorants, fillers like calcium carbonate to bulk it out cheaply. Some plastics are 30 or 40% additive by weight. And those additives can leach out independently of what the polymer itself is doing.
So when we talk about a plastic's environmental behavior, we're actually talking about two things. What happens to the polymer backbone, and what happens to the additive package?
Right. And they don't move at the same speed. A polymer might sit there intact for decades while its plasticizers are slowly bleeding into the surrounding soil or water. Or the reverse. The polymer might start fragmenting, releasing a pulse of additives that were locked inside.
To answer that properly, we need to get into the chemistry. Specifically, what's happening at the molecular level that makes a plastic a plastic?
So let's walk through it. The first big split in the plastics world is between thermoplastics and thermosets. Thermoplastics have linear or branched chains that aren't chemically bonded to each other. You heat them up, the chains slide past each other, the material melts, you can reshape it. That's what makes recycling possible, at least in theory. Thermosets are different. They have cross-linked networks. The chains are chemically bonded into a single giant molecule. You can't melt them. Heat them enough and they just burn.
And the recycling codes? 1 through 7? Those are all thermoplastics?
Mostly. Code 1 is PET, polyethylene terephthalate. That's your water bottles, your soda bottles. It's a polyester, meaning it has ester linkages in the backbone. Code 2 is HDPE, high-density polyethylene, milk jugs, detergent bottles. Simple carbon-carbon backbone, no heteroatoms. Code 3 is PVC, polyvinyl chloride, pipes, window frames, that new shower curtain smell, also CC backbone, but with chlorine atoms hanging off the chain. Code 4 is LDPE, low-density polyethylene, plastic bags, squeeze bottles. Same chemistry as HDPE, but highly branched, which makes it softer and more flexible. Code 5 is PP, polypropylene, yogurt containers, bottle caps, the hinges on those caps, CC backbone with methyl groups. Code 6 is PS, polystyrene, foam cups, takeout containers, the clear rigid stuff in CD cases. CC backbone with benzene rings. Code 7 is the grab bag. Polycarbonate, nylon, acrylic, PLA, ABS. Anything that doesn't fit in 1 through 6.
So if I'm looking at those 7 codes, which ones share the same fundamental backbone chemistry?
Codes 2, 4, 5, and 6. HDPE, LDPE, PP, and PS are all carbon-carbon backbone polymers. Pure hydrocarbon chains. Codes 1 and 3 are where it gets interesting. PET has ester linkages, carbon-oxygen bonds, in the backbone. PVC has carbon-chlorine bonds. And code 7 is everything else, including nylons with amide linkages and PLA with ester linkages.
And the environmental difference between a CC backbone and one with heteroatoms is...
massive. It's the difference between something that can be chemically broken down by water or enzymes and something that basically can't. Carbon-carbon bonds are extremely stable. There's no chemical handle for hydrolysis to grab onto. Microbes don't have enzymes that can cleave a pure hydrocarbon chain, or at least not at any meaningful rate under ambient conditions. So HDPE, PP, and polystyrene, they don't biodegrade. They fragment. UV light and mechanical stress break them into smaller and smaller pieces, but the molecules themselves stay intact. That's the microplastic problem in a nutshell.
Whereas PED has those ester linkages.
Ester linkages can be hydrolyzed. Water can cleave them, given enough heat and the right pH. That's why PET can be chemically recycled back to its monomers. You break the ester bonds and recover terephthalic acid and ethylene glycol. It's also why certain bacteria have evolved enzymes that can degrade PET. The chemistry provides an entry point.
But can be hydrolyzed. Doesn't mean it happens quickly in the ocean.
No. PET is still extremely persistent under ambient conditions. The point is that the potential pathway exists. With polyethylene, there's no pathway. The molecule is a long chain of CH2 groups. There's nothing to attack.
So, the fragmentation rate. How fast a plastic turns into microplastics. That's a different variable from whether it actually breaks down chemically.
And this is where the resin code system completely fails as an environmental guide. Polystyrene, code 6, is brittle. Its glass transition temperature is around 100 degrees Celsius, so at room temperature it's in a glassy state. It shatters. Drop a polystyrene foam cup. It doesn't dent, it cracks. Apply mechanical stress in the environment. Waves, rocks, being run over by a car, and it fragments into dust. That dust is still polystyrene. The molecules haven't changed. But now you've got respirable particles.
Whereas HDPE is tougher.
HDPE is semi-crystalline and has a glass transition temperature well below zero. At room temperature, it's above its glass transition, so it's ductile rather than brittle. It deforms instead of shattering. A milk jug sitting in the environment will get scratched and abraded, but it won't disintegrate into powder the way polystyrene foam does. It stays as larger pieces for much longer.
Which sounds worse? Big chunks of plastic sitting there, but from a microplastic inhalation standpoint...
The polystyrene is generating respirable particles orders of magnitude faster. And those particles carry styrene monomer, which is a suspected carcinogen. So the plastic that looks like it's disappearing faster is actually creating a more serious exposure problem.
That's the kind of counterintuitive detail that makes me want to go back to sleep.
It gets worse because we haven't even talked about PVC yet.
Oh, let's.
PVC, code 3, is a CC backbone polymer with chlorine atoms attached. About 57% chlorine by weight. That chlorine is what makes it flame retardant, which is why it's used in construction. But it's also what makes it a nightmare for disposal. Burn PVC, and you get hydrochloric acid gas and dioxins. Bury it, and the plasticizers leach out. Flexible PVC can be up to 40% phthalate plasticizers by weight. Those phthalates are endocrine disruptors, and the PVC itself doesn't biodegrade because it's still a CC backbone.
So flexible PVC is a triple threat. Toxic additives, toxic combustion products, and persistent polymer.
And it's everywhere. Medical tubing, shower curtains, vinyl flooring, artificial leather, wire insulation. The rigid PVC in pipes has much lower plasticizer content, so it's less of a leaching problem. But the flexible stuff, that's one of the plastics I'd put at the top of the most problematic list.
So we've established that plastics are chemically diverse. Now the million-dollar question, does that diversity actually matter for the environment? And I think you're saying yes, but in ways that aren't intuitive.
Right. The intuitive assumption is biodegradable good, non-biodegradable bad. And the past few years of research have made that assumption look increasingly naive.
This is where the earthworm study comes in.
Yeah. So in early 2025, a group published work looking at what happens when you put biodegradable plastics, specifically PLA and PBAT blends, into agricultural soil. They compared it to conventional HDPE. And the biodegradable plastics cause more toxicity to earthworms.
More.
More. The mechanism they identified was that the biodegradable plastics broke down into smaller particles faster, which sounds good. But those smaller particles released additives and oligomers that were more bioavailable. The HDPE just sat there as larger, less reactive chunks. The earthworms could basically ignore it. The biodegradable stuff turned into a chemical soup in the soil.
So the very thing that makes it biodegradable, the fact that it breaks down, is what made it more harmful in that context.
Because breaks down isn't the same as disappears harmlessly. It means the material fragments and releases its chemical constituents into the surrounding environment. If those constituents are toxic, faster breakdown means faster toxicity.
And PLA specifically, that's the one made from cornstarch, the one that sounds like it should be the good guy.
PLA is the poster child for sounds green, isn't necessarily. It requires industrial composting at 58 degrees Celsius or higher with specific microbial consortia. Drop a PLA cup in your backyard compost pile, and it'll still be there a year later. Drop it in the ocean, and it behaves a lot like conventional plastic. It doesn't degrade at ambient marine temperatures. So you've got a material that markets itself as compostable, but only actually composts in facilities most people don't have access to.
And if it ends up in the regular plastic recycling stream, it contaminates it.
PLA is a nightmare for recyclers. It looks like PET. It's often used in the same applications. Clear cups, clamshell containers, but it melts at a lower temperature and chemically contaminates the PET stream. A small amount of PLA in a batch of recycled PET ruins the mechanical properties.
So what about the genuinely biodegradable ones? The PHAs?
These are interesting. They're produced by bacteria as intracellular carbon storage. Basically, bacterial fat. And because they evolved in natural environments, there are microbes everywhere that know how to eat them. PHAs can degrade in marine environments, in soil, in freshwater. They're biodegradable under ambient conditions.
So why aren't we using them for everything?
Cost and properties. PHAs are expensive to produce, several times the cost of PET or polyethylene. And they're brittle. They have a narrow processing window. Their barrier properties aren't great for food packaging. Material scientists have been working on PHA blends and copolymers for 20 years trying to fix these issues, and they've made progress, but it's still a niche material.
So we're back to trade-offs. The plastic that actually biodegrades in the ocean is too expensive and finicky to replace the plastic that doesn't.
And that's the fundamental tension in the whole field. Every plastic involves trade-offs between cost, performance, degradability, toxicity, and recyclability. There's no free lunch.
What about PEF? I haven't seen that name pop up.
Polyethylene furanoate. It's being positioned as the next generation replacement for PET. It's bio-based, made from plant sugars rather than petroleum, and it has better barrier properties than PET. Oxygen barrier is something like 10 times better, which means you can use thinner packaging for the same shelf life. Coca-Cola and Danone have been investing in it.
But does it actually solve the environmental problem?
That's the question. Early data suggests PEF fragments in the environment similarly to PET. It has ester linkages, so there's a theoretical hydrolysis pathway, but the rates don't look dramatically different. It's better on the front end, renewable feedstock, lower carbon footprint, but on the back end, it's still a persistent polyester. The improvement is real but incremental, not transformative.
We're designing for circularity rather than degradability.
That's actually the smarter approach for a lot of applications. If a plastic is going to be used in a product with a short lifespan, a water bottle, a food container, the ideal scenario is that it gets collected and recycled back into the same product. Chemical recycling of PET, where you break it down to monomers and repolymerize, is technically feasible and already operating at commercial scale. The challenge is collection and sorting, not chemistry.
Whereas if you design for degradability, you're essentially planning for the plastic to escape into the environment.
Which is a realistic planning assumption, given how much plastic does escape. But the problem is that degradable and recyclable are often in tension. A plastic that's designed to fall apart under environmental conditions is harder to keep stable through multiple use cycles. You're optimizing for different endpoints.
Let's talk about the ones that deserve the most scrutiny. If you had to make a list of the most problematic plastics right now.
Number 1, no question, polystyrene foam. It's brittle, it fragments into dust, there's essentially no recycling infrastructure for it, and it contains residual styrene monomer, which is a suspected carcinogen. It's lightweight, so it blows around and ends up in waterways. And it's used for applications that last 15 minutes, coffee cups, takeout containers, packaging peanuts.
It combines maximum environmental dispersion with maximum fragmentation and a toxicity concern.
Minimum recyclability. It's the worst of all worlds. Number 2 on my list would be flexible PVC. The plasticizer load is the main issue, phthalates leaching out over the product's lifetime. And when PVC does get into the environment, the chlorine content makes it particularly problematic if it ever gets burned, which it does in informal recycling operations and landfill fires.
And number 3?
Oxo-degradable plastics. These deserve a special mention because they're the perfect example of a solution that made the problem worse.
I've seen those. Plastic bags that claim to be degradable.
Right. Oxo-degradable plastics are conventional plastics, usually polyethylene or polypropylene, with metal salt additives that catalyze oxidation. The idea was that they'd break down faster in the environment. And they do, but only into smaller pieces. The additives cause the polymer chains to fragment, but there's no biodegradation step. You just get microplastics faster.
It's a plastic bag that turns into a million tiny plastic particles instead of one big plastic bag.
The EU banned them in 2021 for exactly this reason. The European Commission's scientific advisory body concluded there was no evidence they biodegrade in marine environments within a reasonable time frame, and they actually increase microplastic pollution.
They were marketed as the green option.
For years. And consumers paid extra for them. It's a cautionary tale about what happens when you optimize for one visible property. It disappears faster without understanding what's actually happening chemically.
If those are the most problematic, what are the least problematic? From an environmental persistence standpoint.
HDPE is near the top. Simple chemistry, just carbon and hydrogen. Low additive load in most applications. Doesn't fragment easily because it's ductile. Relatively high recycling rates, around 30% for bottles in the U.S., higher in places with deposit systems. And because the chemistry is simple, the recycled material is fairly clean.
The milk jug sitting in a landfill for 100 years. That's not ideal, but it's also not actively poisoning anything.
It's inert. It's just there. which isn't a great outcome, but compared to polystyrene foam dispersing carcinogenic dust into the air, or flexible PVC leaching endocrine disruptors into groundwater, inert and contained, starts to look like a reasonable option.
Polypropylene?
Similar story. Simple chemistry, low toxicity, durable. Recycling rates are lower than HDPE, more like 1 to 3% in the US for consumer packaging, but the material itself is benign. The main environmental concern with PP is just that it persists, not that it's actively harmful while persisting.
And PET?
PET is in the middle. The ester linkages mean there's a theoretical degradation pathway, and chemical recycling is viable. But it's still persistent under ambient conditions, and it's used in massive volumes for single-use applications. The antimony catalysts used in some PET production are a concern. Antimony trioxide is a suspected carcinogen, and trace amounts can leach into bottled water, especially if the bottle gets hot.
Wait, the bottle itself can leach antimony into the water?
At very low levels, yes. Well below regulatory limits in most cases, but it's been documented. It's another example of how the plastic is never just the polymer.
Given all this complexity, what should we actually do with this information? Let's get practical.
I think the first thing is to stop using the resin code as an environmental scorecard. That little triangle with a number, it tells you what the polymer is for sorting purposes. It doesn't tell you whether the plastic is recyclable in practice, whether it's toxic, whether it fragments, or what additives are in it. Code 7 in particular, that's the wild card. It could be polycarbonate with bisphenol A, or it could be PLA, or it could be nylon. The number tells you almost nothing.
What should people actually look for?
If you're trying to minimize environmental harm, prioritize HDPE and PP. They're the simplest chemistries, lowest additive loads, least likely to fragment into respirable particles. Avoid polystyrene foam and flexible PVC where you can. And be deeply skeptical of biodegradable claims unless you know exactly what polymer you're dealing with and you have access to the specific disposal infrastructure it requires.
The PLA compostable cup that goes in the trash because there's no industrial composting facility within 50 miles, that's not a win.
It's worse than if you just used a conventional plastic cup, because the PLA cup used agricultural land to grow the corn feedstock and then failed to deliver any end-of-life benefit. It's a net negative.
The bigger picture framework. You mentioned matching the plastic to the use case.
Right. The worst outcome is a plastic that's neither durable nor degradable. It just fragments. Single-use applications should use the simplest, lowest additive plastics with existing recycling infrastructure. That means PET and HDPE for most packaging. Long-life applications, pipes, window frames, medical devices, Euroboxes, should use durable plastics designed for decades of service. PVC in pipes is a perfectly reasonable application because the material is rigid, the plasticizer load is low, and the service life is 50 years or more.
The problem is, when you take a durable plastic and use it for 30 seconds...
That's the core mismatch. A polyethylene bag that's used for 15 minutes and then spends 500 years in a landfill. The material is doing exactly what it was designed to do, which isn't breakdown. The problem isn't the chemistry, it's the application.
What about the new materials on the horizon? You mentioned PEF and PHAs. Is there anything that actually changes the picture?
The most interesting development, I think, isn't a new polymer. It's chemical recycling. If we can efficiently break PET and other polyesters back down to pure monomers and repolymerize them, we close the loop without needing the material to be biodegradable. That's a fundamentally different approach than make it, use it, hope it decomposes. It's make it, use it, unmake it, remake it.
Which requires collection infrastructure.
And that's the non-chemistry problem that chemistry can't solve. The best polymer in the world doesn't matter if it ends up in a ditch.
We're left with a question that material scientists are still wrestling with.
We are. How do we evaluate new polymers before they're ubiquitous? The history of plastics is full of solutions that created new problems. BPA-free polycarbonate replacements that turned out to have similar endocrine activity. Oxo-degradable additives that accelerated microplastic formation. PLA that sounds green but requires industrial composting most people can't access.
The pattern seems to be, we identify a problem with an existing material, we rush out a replacement, and 10 years later, we discover the replacement has its own problems.
Because we evaluate materials on one or two dimensions, carbon footprint, or biodegradability, or recyclability, instead of looking at the full life cycle. What happens when it fragments? What additives does it need? What disposal infrastructure actually exists? What are the combustion products if it gets burned in an informal landfill?
The uncomfortable truth is, we don't have a perfect plastic.
We don't. Every choice involves trade-offs. HDPE is inert and recyclable, but it persists essentially forever. PET can be chemically recycled, but it still fragments and leaches catalyst residues. PLA is bio-based, but doesn't biodegrade where it usually ends up. PHAs actually biodegrade, but they're too expensive and finicky for mass adoption. There's no material that scores well on every axis.
The best we can do is make informed trade-offs.
Match the material to the application. Don't use a 500-year plastic for a 5-minute job. Don't use a toxic, additive-loaded plastic for something that touches food or water. Don't use a brittle, fragmenting plastic for anything that's likely to escape collection.
Don't trust the little triangle.
The little triangle is a sorting code. It's not a report card.
If I'm standing in the grocery store holding two containers, one says code 5PP, one says code 7 with compostable on it, which one do I actually buy?
Take the polypropylene. Seriously. The code 7 compostable is probably PLA, and unless you know for certain that your municipality has an industrial composting facility that accepts it, and most don't, it's going to a landfill where it won't degrade, or it's contaminating a recycling stream. The PP container has a known chemistry, low toxicity, and at least some chance of being recycled.
It's counterintuitive, but the less green-sounding option is often the better environmental choice once you trace the actual disposal pathway.
Thanks, Hilbert. That's exactly the kind of question people should be asking.
The open question we're left with, and I think this is where material science needs to go, is how we evaluate new polymers before they scale. We've been burned too many times by solutions that look good on one metric and turned out to be worse on three others. We need a framework that looks at the full life cycle, including realistic end-of-life scenarios, before a material gets deployed in billions of units.
That framework has to include the messy reality of how plastic actually gets disposed of, not how it's supposed to get disposed of, how it actually does. Because designing for a world with perfect recycling infrastructure is designing for a world that doesn't exist.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for the question, and to Daniel for the prompt that made us go all the way back to chemistry class.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more deep dives into the materials that make up modern life, tell us what fundamental questions we should tackle next. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.